Good day and welcome to the Back to Work series, the Continuing Judicial Vacancy Crisis Conference Call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Paula Sheik. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Tim. And thank you, everyone, for joining today's teleconference call. My name is Paula Sheik. I am the Deputy Director of Network Advancement at ACS. And in a continuing effort to provide scalable programming to our members nationwide, ACS has put together this teleconference series on Back to Work, What Prospects in Progress in Congress this Fall. Given that the government shutdown is now in its fourth day, it seems clear that there may not be much prospect for progress, but I'll let our featured speaker give us more information about that. Last week, we had a very informative call on the current state of comprehensive immigration reform and heard from Hill staff both from the House and Senate side, as well as an immigrants' rights advocate from the ACLU. We will be hosting a recording of all of these conference calls on a members-only page on the website upon completion of the series, so you can look out for that. Today's call focuses on the continuing judicial vacancy crisis, with 95 current and 17 future vacancies in the federal courts and 39 jurisdictions operating under a judicial emergency. Judicial vacancies continue to create crises in our courts. The fight over the D.C. Circuit, its nominees, and its number of seats provides the latest evidence of bitter divisions in the Senate over federal judges and courts. This call will address the prospects for nominations, confirmations, and the remainder of this Congress, as well as what ACS members can do to elevate awareness on this issue to the public at large and help address this crisis. I am so very proud to introduce all of you to today's featured speaker and longtime ACS supporter, Robert Raven. Robert's extensive and incredibly impressive career includes years in private practice at Arnold and Porter, followed by time in academia as an adjunct professor at Georgetown University Law School, and of course, his highly respected legislative career. He began as counsel on Congressman Barney Frank's staff, where he served for 7 years. While there, Robert advised the then congressman on issues before the Judiciary Committee and on national civil rights policy and politics. From there, he went on to join the committee itself as Democratic counsel for the Subcommittee on the Constitution. And in 1999, he was appointed by the White House to the Justice Department as the Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs. Robert is now the president and founder of the Raven Group, where he helps his clients identify and achieve complex public policy objectives. He hails from the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business and from New York University's Law School. He's an active member of many communities, and I'm sure that many of you know him well in advance of this call. This includes being president of the Hispanic Bar Association's D.C. Foundation, as well as serving for a very long time on the ACS National Board of Directors. I could go on, but it's more important for everyone to hear from him. I'll now turn it over to Robert, who will discuss the continuing judicial vacancy crisis for roughly 20 minutes, and then we will open up to a question and answer session. Our operator will instruct you on how to unmute yourself to ask a question at that time. Also, please note that if you are a member of the media and are asking a question, we ask that you provide the media group that you represent. Thank you so much, and let me just turn it over to Robert.
Thank you. I should stop right after that introduction. No more. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk extremely quickly and then open it up to what's on your mind and allow you all to direct the conversation. But I so much admire and appreciate the American Constitution Society's very significant investment in the important question of the composition of the federal judiciary, both the substance of the candidates who presidents propose to the Congress and the confirmation process itself. It's a crucial function for the organization. I am able to observe firsthand how much of people's time and resources ACS puts into this issue, and I am a witness to what a difference it makes. So I jumped at the opportunity to visit with y'all and talk about this issue because you matter. The process is terrible. I think any sentient being can observe from wherever you are in the country that the manner in which judges are identified, selected, vetted, and moved through the system or not is not a shining beacon of constitutional prowess, but the process is the way it is for a very distinct reason. The right has known for a number of decades now that the composition of the Article III courts has an enormous effect on public policy in the United States. And the right has been assertive and smart about investing in a political infrastructure to influence the outcome of the composition of the judiciary. Almost 1,000 federal judges and many entities and funders within the right have known for a long time that who serves on the court really matters. The left, and of course I'm speaking glibly and there are exceptions to the general rules that I'm laying out, but the general rules are in fact rules. The left has treated it as more of an academic and intellectual exercise and has had a much harder time creating coherence, certainly with a political infrastructure in support of it, to identify, vet, support, and advocate for candidates whom we think have a vibrant and expansive view of how public policy can be used to protect American civil rights, civil liberties, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the result of that imbalance in interest in the politics of the composition of the court results in the process we have today, where the right is more effective at gumming up the works and laying objections in front of the success of candidates who come up from a Democratic president than the left is with the right. I am not shy. I've been working on judges for more than 20 years, and I'm not shy about talking about the politics of the process because it's a 100% political process. The identification and selection of federal judges starts with a senator. In every state, a senator recommends or has some say in the candidacy of every single vacancy in the federal court. Senators are political creatures. I love that. I care deeply about politics, electoral politics, and the role that elected officials have in the regulation of our lives. It's a 100% political process. How you can not treat a 100% political process with a full-bore political effort, either votes or money or advocacy or constituent support, that is the tactical mechanics that go into a modern political exercise, is bewildering to me. So I and people I love spend a lot of time investing in the fact and acknowledging the fact that the selection of federal judges starts with politics, and the more the left is willing to accept that and improve the political infrastructure, the better, faster, swifter, smarter the cohort will be. The crisis that we have is rather significant. It manifests itself quite concretely in gross and disgusting backlogs, particularly on the civil docket, in many, many jurisdictions. Those of you who are practitioners know that it can be and is exceptionally frustrating to wait 2 or 3 years for the adjudication, and sometimes even in the first measure, first blush, review of a classic civil case in a number of our jurisdictions. The vacancies, the backlog, the wait is unacceptable. It's a stain on our democracy, but it's a fact. We continue to have, notwithstanding very vibrant efforts from the Obama administration and the Senate Judiciary Committee, we continue to have approximately a tenth of the federal judiciary vacant at any one time. It has hovered between 90 and 110 vacancies for a long time. 271 judges have been named in the 4.5 years by the Obama administration, 205 of those confirmed. But almost 27% of the entire judiciary has been named by the Obama administration. So the churn is quite significant. But the vacancy rate remains hovering around 10%, and the results of that are quite staggering, as I talked about with the backlog and the wait time. The time it takes to get a candidate through the process has been elongated, I won't say exponentially, but it's been elongated regrettably in the last 5 and 6 years, last 3 or 4 years. The average wait time for a Bush nominee was 46 days from nomination to confirmation. The average wait time for an Obama nominee in the Senate is 115 days. And that is not mostly because the Senate Judiciary Committee, now chaired by Senator Leahy, is less productive. It's mostly about obstructions within committee or wait time on the floor. The I'll say one more thing and then I'll stop and open it up to questions. On the very, very exciting side, President Obama has made it a priority, and his White House counsel staff have been able to manifest his priority, the diversity of the nominees. And diversity in an almost plenary sense, except for one. 41% of the nominees that President Obama has sent up are women. 16% African American, 13% Hispanic, 8% Asian American, and he is the president who, because of the place and time in which we are in the American public, has been able to send up a significant number of openly gay and lesbian professionals as judges, most of whom have been confirmed, which is a tremendous change from what his predecessors were able to or chose to do. The diversity of professional backgrounds from which these nominees come is different from the past, but still not where we need to be, and that's for a variety of structural reasons that have impeded the president's ability to get the kind of true diversity. Small town practitioners, solo practitioners, law school professors, public defenders, federal defenders. We still don't have enough of those people going through the system. And parts of that, and I can talk about it more in question and answers if you like, parts of that are due to the incredible procedural hurdles that a nominee has to go through now in order to get from beginning to end. And many of those people who aren't at either government jobs to begin with or law firms that will sustain a pendency of 150 or 200 days for a candidacy, if they don't have that kind of institutional support, it's very hard for them to get through this now regrettably elongated system. I will stop there. I am deeply, deeply interested and excited to talk about how ACS members and supporters can make a difference in the communities in which you live. The short version is, if you accept my premise that all of this starts with politics, then being involved with your senators, the senators' judicial selection committees within the states, the House of Representative delegations that sometimes have good working relationships with the senators, the media in your community to which the senators are attentive, relationships with donors in your state to whom senators are sometimes attentive. I'm ticking off the various portals through which solid members of the legal community in any city can get involved with the judicial selection process that their senators rely on. There are so many ways to get involved. Wringing our hands and lamenting what a crappy process it is not true political engagement. Political engagement means stepping up and participating in some of the tactical things that I just mentioned. And I'm delighted to talk about in the Q&A what that might look like if people would like. I'll stop there and thank you so much for taking the time to plug in to an issue that so many of us are very passionate about and work very hard on.
Thank you so much, Robert. That was excellent. I think you have a wonderful way of just describing this awful crisis, but also giving people hope that there is stuff that we can all do. I'm going to turn it over to our operator to provide instructions on how to set up a question. And I'm just going to let everyone know that if you join the call after the instructions in the very beginning, I hope that you stay on through the question and answers, because one of the things that I've noticed is through these teleconference series, this is usually where a lot of the very important information comes out. So please stay on. And Tim, with that, you can go ahead and provide the instructions.
And at this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, if you're with the media, please identify the group you represent before posing your question. Once again, that's star one to ask a question. We'll pause for a moment to assemble the queue.
And actually, I did receive some questions over email during this call, so I'll go ahead and start with those while people are coming up with their questions. So one of the questions that we received beforehand, Robert, was, is there any way to better engage the administration in the process before the midterm election?
Yes. A couple things. Speak out. It's a representative democracy. Write letters to the editor. Talk to your senators to push the administration to continue processing nominees at a steady clip. If you're able, reach out to the national organizations that you care about that work on this issue. So obviously the American Constitution Society, People for the American Way, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, the Alliance for Justice. On the left, we have a fantastic, huge veneer of subject matter organizations that care about the composition of the judiciary, the Sierra Club, Defenders of Wildlife, reproductive rights groups, unions, national minority organizations, the Inc. Fund, MALDEF, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a myriad of subject matter interest groups that put staff and time into worrying about the pace and composition of the judiciary. And each of those organizations has some relationship with the White House Counsel and the Obama administration. So if you have the direct relationship with your senator or senator staff or are willing to form that, go ahead and do that. If those of you who have been donors want to go back to your finance committee people around the campaign and talk to them, that can be useful, and or working through the national organizations who have people like Pollack and others on staff who are smart and pay attention to the details, working with them directly to figure out how working in your state can make the difference. The system is completely, completely decentralized. Each senator runs his or her own show. The White House does its piece. The White House is dominant on circuit court nominations, but even then can't really get a nominee over the objection of that state senator. On the district court level, the senators have the run of show. And so whatever state you live in, you have an ability / responsibility to work with your senator, whether your senator is a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent, to express your view about either the pace, the composition of the judiciary, or a particular candidate.
Okay. I have a few more questions that have come in over email, so I'll go ahead and continue reading other people's questions. But if you do have a question, please feel free to press star one and go ahead and put yourself in the queue. So, Robert, you just spoke about the fact that it is a very decentralized system and that each state has its own way of doing it. What is your opinion on the general use of commissions, nominating commissions? And if you're not on a nominating commission, what can you do to put someone forward on that commission?
So every state is different. The systems vary from state to state. Some of them are beautiful, cooperative, have lots of substantive integrity. There's a real due diligence. They take all comers. They interview people. They do it in groups. They process recommendations to the senators, and that's that. And others are Potemkin villages, where reasonable men and women are constituted, and they report back to the senator that which the senator asks them to report out. And it's everything in between. Some states have bipartisan commissions, Pennsylvania, Florida, possibly Wisconsin, where the Democrat and the Republican senator in those states agree to do it together. They tend to be slower, but the candidate that comes out, with some exception, is then pretty much a safe bet to make it through the Senate. Other states divide up the vacancies between senators. Could be 1-to-1 in some states. It could be 3-to-1 in some states, depending on the senior senator's interest and goal. So every state is sui generis. Whether or not your state's judicial selection committee is solid and substantive, or more of a makeshift or a smokescreen, you got to get involved. Find a way to serve on the committee. Find a way to meet people who serve on the committee. It's highly likely that unless you're a very recent law grad, it's highly likely that you don't have one degree of separation from sitting members of these committees. Take the time to go meet them. Learn about what the process is like. Learn about what a viable candidate is like. Treat it like an important advocacy campaign vis-a-vis that committee.
That's excellent. Thank you. I'm just going to go through my list of emailed questions. This one I think is important, and I think a lot of people have been paying attention. Can you talk to us about how things have played out in the D.C. circuit and what that means to the larger progressive movement? The second part of the question is, and the larger conversation about courts.
Yes. So the D.C. circuit, which many people consider to be a crown jewel in the system, because it's both had a reputation for being a feeder to the Supreme Court and because it handles so many very hard public policy questions of administrative law that come out of the government, is also a platform for a lot of political wrangling. There are vacancies on the court and three superb nominees pending in the United States Senate to fill those vacancies, and some of you know that many in the two political parties have taken kind of hardening positions. Many on the right believe that the court doesn't need more judges and have made their case that whether or not they approve of the three pending candidates, there's no need for an additional candidate on the D.C. Circuit because of lower caseload. Many on the left say, A, that's disingenuous, and B, these are great candidates, move them along. And so we are, as we speak, in the middle of that conversation going on the Senate floor and in the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's not clear how it will break. The caseload argument is hard for people to get their hands around. There's a quantitative and a qualitative piece to it. On the quantitative side, people say that the docket is relatively low. It was pointed out, I forget if it was the Alliance for Justice or another organization, they did a side-by-side and pointed out that the caseload per judge is lower in the Tenth Circuit than the D.C. Circuit, and during the recent confirmation hearing of a Tenth Circuit judge, none of the objectors to caseload said anything about caseload ratio as an important or certainly dispositive variable in the fight. So it's an interesting forensic to perhaps make more apparent the largely disingenuous notion that it's caseload that stops people from being confirmed in the D.C. Circuit, and it's more about doing everything you can to make sure that the at least quantitative balance on the circuit is not from a democratically nominated president, which would be the case if 1, 2, and 3 of these judges were actually confirmed. I am cautiously optimistic that these three judges will be confirmed. They're qualified, they're smart, they're excellent, but we are in the middle of a wrangle over what I think is a pretextual argument that because of caseload, we don't need these judges.
Okay. I think that this is going to. No, we do have a question, actually. Let's go ahead and take the question from Tim. Can you plug in the person that has the question, please?
Yes, we have a question from James Colligan. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm wondering what's the ABA's role in the process, and has it been the same role through the past administrations?
Yes, with some exception. There was a period of time, I think, in the Bush administration when they didn't rely on an ABA recommendation. But we are back to relying on the ABA to do its endorsement process. The White House has an informal protocol where they send their desired nominees over to the ABA committee, which has a formal name, but I'm blanking on it right now. And the ABA committee has hardworking volunteer lawyers around the country who serve on this committee who do the due diligence and come up with a qualified, very qualified, not qualified recommendation to, and it's a confidential recommendation, and it's made to the White House and to the Senate Judiciary Committee. People, particularly on the left, the right complained about the ABA because they thought the ABA was wrongly a left-wing institution. The left sometimes complains about the ABA because it's a bit opaque what the standards are for vetting and recommendation. It is, while they don't publish their results, we have informal and anecdotal data that women and minorities fare have much more rocky and troubled waters in this selection committee than white guys. And minority bar organizations have been working with the ABA to figure out why and what to do about that. Also, there are processes within the ABA selection committee that make people think that it's less scientific and rigorous than you might hope, given how important the ABA is as an institution. But the short answer is yes. All the judges, candidates are vetted, and a due diligence report is submitted to the Senate Judiciary Committee and the White House with a recommendation. I'll add that the minority bars, particularly the Hispanic National Bar and the Asian American Bar, have a pretty robust endorsements process, which at least the HNBA one is open to candidates who are not Hispanic. And that, too, results in an endorsement or not of candidates, and candidates and others are then free to use that endorsement as part of their advocacy.
That's very helpful. One of my biggest questions, and I think anyone that's deeply committed to this issue and has been working on this issue, would like to know if you have or if you've seen what is the most effective way to get people that are not lawyers to care about the judicial vacancy crisis in this country. I know that we constantly talk about it in the office, about getting non-lawyers more deeply committed to this issue. Have you seen a group or individual or a campaign of any kind do this successfully, or do you have thoughts on how to do it successfully?
Well, we have great evidence of particularized cases and facts that grip people and draw their attention. So, what happened to Lilly Ledbetter in Alabama is a pretty paradigmatic example of how a lousy fact pattern and a lousy result with some communications and advocacy infrastructure behind it can capture the American public's attention to make a broader point that the composition of the judiciary really matters. And so we have isolated examples of where we can bring it home to people who may not be or interested in the details of substantive due process, but actually, you know, give a shit about how Americans' lives are lived. And it's incumbent upon advocates, lawyers or not, to bring to life to busy, ordinary, distracted Americans about why who is wearing the robe matters. And, you know, I'll point out an area where we haven't been able to do it, even though it should be easy pickings, mandatory arbitration and the incredible, the galloping ahead that these activist judges from the right have been doing to circumscribe and to limit the ability of modest income consumers to find a real process to get redress for these contracts of adhesions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we wonky lawyers talk about it in lawyer terms as opposed to explaining to Mrs. Johnson how the contract she signed with fill in the blank means she'd have to travel to Arizona if she lived in New York to get redress for her, you know, $79 a month fill in the blank, whatever she bought. And we're pretty bad at that. Mm-hmm. And we need to work together to figure out much better forensics and narratives to connect with the American public on how these doctrinal issues brought to you again and again by a very activist court that absolutely knows what it's doing is wreaking havoc on the lives of ordinary Americans and the power imbalance between them and corporate America. So, what can individuals do? They can work in their communities or with these national organizations, support them financially, but get involved to help them improve their ability to make the narratives around this stuff much more like Lilly Ledbetter. We know how to do this. We just don't invest much in it.
Thank you. That was really an excellent answer to the question, and I think something that we've talked about and need our members and others help on creating those narratives and finding those narratives and then making people aware of them. With that, I actually think we are able to conclude the call. Robert, if there's anything else you'd like to say, please go ahead, and then I'll just address some housekeeping matters.
No, I want to underscore the importance of ACS's, yes, I want to underscore the importance of ACS's role in this. At ACS, we don't endorse judges. What we do is endorse a process for the selection and confirmation of judges who will give Americans a chance and have a demonstrated commitment and life experience which captures the diversity, which is our magnificent country, the opportunity of so many lawyers who don't necessarily come out of the hegemonic and rigid, you know, I went to Yale, I clerked for a circuit court judge, I worked at Wachtell Lipton, and now I want to be a judge. There's nothing wrong with that, but we have so much more to offer. As a country and as a profession, and ACS and other organizations with whom it works, with which it works, are deeply committed to making sure that the White House and the Senate Judiciary Committee sees that enormous diversity and manifests it on the bench. And the fact that you have Sri Srinivasan, the first South Asian on a circuit court in this nation's 230-year history, the fact that you have openly gay judges, the fact that you have the federal public defender from Southern California, now a federal court judge, the fact that you have the first African-American woman federal judge in Mississippi, these are not coincidences of nature. This is a result of extremely hard and tedious and underfunded work from organizations like ACS and others to make sure that this is a priority for this president and the senators in a nonpartisan way on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And we're kicking ass, and we need your help.
I don't think anyone could have put that better. Thank you so much, Robert. You are the perfect person for this call and such a great asset to ACS and so many other groups that you are a part of. With that, I want to thank everybody for joining today's call. It's the second in our series. The last one for the specific series will be held on Monday, October 7th, and that will be on it will be with Peter Shane, a professor from Ohio State University Law School, and it will be on the showdown between Congress and the President, which, given everything that's happened this last week, should be an exciting conference call, to say the least. The time of that call will be 4 p.m. Eastern, so please note the time change. And also, if you are interested in receiving CLE for any of these calls, we are offering half of a CLE credit. It is approved by California MCLE. And you can email in their instructions at the bottom of all the announcements. Your name, the subject line should reflect the call that you are on, your name, your bar number, the state that you're looking for credit in, and we will follow up with the documents that you need to receive that. Thank you, everyone, for joining, and I hope to see you all or hear you all or be with you all on the next call. Thanks again, and thank you, Robert.
And that concludes today's conference call. We appreciate your participation.